It was 7:30 p.m., and Millie was still at her desk, the glow of her dual monitors illuminating the exhaustion etched onto her face. She wasn't staying late because of the workload. She was staying late because she was trying to time her exit. She needed to leave when he wasn't looking. Kevin sat three rows over, his silhouette visible against the darkened window. He was a nice guy. That's what everyone in HR called him. He brought donuts on Fridays. He remembered birthdays. But to Millie, Kevin was a suffocating fog that she couldn't wave away. It had started innocently enough. Coffee runs, shared grievances about management. But when Millie had politely declined his invitation to dinner 3 months ago, explaining she had a boyfriend, the shift was toxic. Her phone buzzed on the desk. A text. Kevin. Saw you're still online. I ordered Thai. Enough for two. Don't want you starving. Millie's stomach turned. She typed back quickly. Thanks, Kevin, but I'm actually just leaving. Heading to Ben's. She grabbed her purse and stood up, but Kevin was already there, standing at the end of her row. He was smiling, that tight, closed mouth smile that didn't reach his eyes. Ben can wait, can he? Kevin asked, leaning casually against a filing cabinet, blocking her path to the elevator. You looked wrecked, Mills. You need protein. I'm fine, Kevin, really. And please don't call me Mills.
Just trying to help.
You know, looking at the Q3 projections, I noticed some errors in your data. I fixed them for you. Didn't want you getting flagged by corporate. He held her gaze a second too long. It was his new tactic. He would withhold emails, only to forward them at the last minute, just in case she missed it. He would insert himself into her projects, forcing late-night collaboration sessions.
I didn't ask you to do that, she said, stepping around him.
You're welcome. Ben doesn't appreciate how hard you work.
If I were him, I'd never let you out of my sight.
By the time that Millie got to the apartment that she shared with Ben, she was shaking. Ben was in the kitchen, chopping vegetables.
He did it again?
Ben asked. He didn't look up, but his grip on the knife tightened.
He fixed my work,
Millie said, pouring herself a glass of juice with trembling hands.
He went into my files, Ben. He changed things so he could take credit for saving me. And he texted me 14 times today. 14! I feel like I'm going crazy. HR says unless he makes a direct threat, it's just interpersonal friction.
Ben turned around. His eyes were dark, unreadable. He walked over to her, taking the glass from her hand and setting it down. He held her face.
I'm done with this. I'm done watching you shrink because of him.
I don't know what to do. If I report him again, he'll escalate. He's obsessed.
I know. So we're gonna give him what he wants.
What?
Invite him over, Ben said.
Are you insane? Millie pulled back. That is the last thing I want.
Not for a date, Millie. For a lesson.
Ben walked back to the counter and picked up his phone. He scrolled for a moment and then looked at her. I have a friend. He deals in exotic imports.
Ben, you're scaring me. What are you talking about?
Text him. Tell him you and I had a fight. Tell him I stormed out. Tell him you're lonely and you realized he was right all along. Tell him to come here. Tonight.
And then what?
Then we play a game.
Kevin stared at his phone, the blue light illuminating his small, meticulous apartment. He read the message for the 10th time. It was from Millie.
You were right. He doesn't appreciate me. He left. I'm alone, and I really need someone who understands me. Can you come over? please?
A surge of indignation rushed through him, hot and electric. He knew it. He had known it for months. It was a war of attrition, and he had finally worn down the walls. That idiot, Ben, was out of the picture. He showered quickly, dousing himself in cologne. He checked his reflection. He looked good, reliable, accessible. He grabbed a jacket and headed out into the cool Chicago night. He arrived at her apartment complex at 9 p.m. exactly. When Millie opened the door, she looked flushed.
Kevin, you came.
Of course I came, Kevin said, stepping into the warmth of the apartment. He scanned the room.
Is he gone? He took a bag. I don't think he's coming back.
She led him to the sofa. On the coffee table, there was a six-pack of heavy stout beers, three already opened.
I started without you, she said, forcing a giggle that sounded brittle to her own ears.
She handed him a bottle.
Catch up.
Kevin took the beer, his eyes scanning her.
I'm sorry you're going through this, Millie. But honestly, it's for the best. You deserve someone who puts you first.
I know that now, Millie said.
Drink up. I don't want to think tonight.
Ben had instructed her, fill him up. Keep the fluids coming. Don't let him stop drinking. Millie played her part, though her heart hammered against her ribs like a trapped bird. She complimented Kevin's work ethic. She touched his arm. She poured him another beer. And another. Kevin was in ecstasy.
You know, Kevin slurred slightly, his face red. I always knew we'd end up here. It's just chemistry. You can't resist.
You're so smart, Millie said, opening the next bottle.
Here, finish this one.
Kevin drank it.
Bathroom?
He asked.
Down the hall, first door on the left, Millie said.
As Kevin stood up, swaying slightly, Millie felt a chill crawl up her spine. She knew what was in there. Ben had spent 20 minutes in the bathroom before Kevin arrived. He had come out carrying a heavy canvas sack, which was now empty.
Don't fall in,
she called out, her voice trembling. Kevin winked.
Be right back, babe.
He stumbled down the hallway. Millie sat frozen on the couch. Inside the bathroom, Kevin felt like the king of the world.
He was in Millie's apartment. Ben was gone. Tonight, he was going to make his move.
He lifted the toilet lid, not bothering to look down immediately as he reached for the light switch that he had missed on the way in. The bathroom was bathed in a dim amber light from a nightlight plugged into the wall. Kevin sat down heavily, sighing with relief as he relaxed his muscles. And that was when he felt the tickle. It wasn't water splashing up. It was something muscular and dry brushing against his thigh just below the rim of the seat. Kevin frowned, looking down between his legs.
What the?
The strike was faster than light. A triangular head lunged upward from the S-bend of the toilet bowl. It wasn't a garden snake. It was thick, patterned with dark diamonds, and angry at being confined in the cold porcelain water. The pain was instantaneous and blinding. He scrambled backward, tripping over his pants, which were still around his ankles. He crashed into the bathtub, the shower curtain tearing down with him. In the living room, Millie jumped up to her feet, covering her mouth. The door to the bedroom opened, and Ben stepped out. He looked calm, terrifyingly calm.
Ben, oh my God!
Wait, Ben said. From the bathroom came the sounds of chaotic destruction. Bottles shattering,
a body thrashing against the tile, and Kevin screaming, "Snake! There's a snake! Help me!"
The bathroom door rattled violently as Kevin tried to unlock it with shaking, panicked hands. Finally, the lock gave way. Kevin burst into the hallway. He looked up and saw Ben. Ben stood in the center of the living room, arms crossed, staring at Kevin with a look of utter disgust. "Snake? In a Chicago high-rise? Whew, you must be hallucinating, Kevin. You shouldn't drink so much." Kevin's eyes darted between Millie and Ben. The venom, or perhaps just the sheer shock of the trauma, was making him dizzy.
You...
Kevin gasped, pointing a shaking finger at them. "You... I think you should leave before you hurt yourself further." Kevin didn't need to be told twice. The silence that followed was heavy. Millie walked slowly to the bathroom door and peered inside. The water in the toilet bowl was rippling. A dark, scaly coil was slowly retreating back down the pipe, seeking darkness. She turned to Ben. She felt sick, but also light. Lighter than she had felt in months.
Is it poisonous?" she asked.
"Venomous. And no, it's a ball python. I rented it. It has teeth and it hurts like hell, but he's not going to die." Ben walked over to the bathroom, peering at the snake with a detached curiosity. Although, the infection from a toilet snake bite, that's going to require some awkward explanations at the ER.
You are the best, Ben."
The next day at work, Kevin's desk was empty. An email went out around noon stating that Kevin had taken an immediate leave of absence due to a medical emergency. He never returned to the office. 2 weeks later, Millie heard through the grapevine that he had transferred to a branch in Ohio. He had requested to work fully remote, citing severe anxiety.
It was 2018, and I just landed a gig as a roadie for a mid-tier indie band touring Australia. The place was cheap, $200 a week for a room in a three-bedroom house. My roommates were these two girls, Kylie and Jess, both in their early 20s. Full-on bogans with bleached hair, trackies, and a vocabulary that could make a sailor blush. They were sisters, actually. Kylie the older one, loud and bossy. Jess quieter, but with a mean streak. I figured it was temporary. I'd crash there between tours, save some cash, and move on. At first it wasn't too bad. We'd share smokes on the back porch, blasting AC/DC from a busted speaker. Kylie worked at a bottle shop, Jess at a servo, and they'd come home with six packs and stories about idiotic customers.
"Oi, Noah, you should have seen this guy trying to chat me up today,"
Kylie would say, cracking open a VB.
"Tell him to buzz off and buy his own piss,"
Kylie would say, "pour myself one, and we watch footy on the telly." I kept to myself mostly, tinkering with my guitar, packing for the next leg of the tour. But they were messy, dishes piled up, empty stubbies everywhere, and they partied hard. More than once, I came home to find strangers passed out on the couch. Things started getting tense around month three. They were always short on rent, blaming it on pay or the pokies ate my cash. I'd cover for them, figuring it even out. Kylie started seeing this bloke Shane, a tattooed tradie with a temper. He'd show up unannounced, revving his ute outside, and they'd argue loud enough to wake the neighbors. One night, I heard crashing from her room, glass breaking, her yelling,
"Get your hands off me, you m-!"
I knocked and asked if she was all right.
"Mind your own business, Noah,"
she shouted through the door. Next morning, she had a shiner, purple and swollen. "Slipped in the shower," she said, avoiding my eyes. Jess just shrugged. "Shane's a prick, but she loves him." I didn't push it. Who was I to get involved? But it happened again a couple weeks later. Bruises on her arms, a split lip.
"Fell off me bike,"
she claimed. Shane was hitting her, no doubt. Jess confided in me one night. He's always been like that. Kylie thinks she can change him. I suggested she call the cops or a hotline, but Kylie overheard and went off.
You think you're better than us, you posh Yank? Stay out of it!
I wasn't a Yank. I was born in Sydney to American parents. But whatever. Tensions rose, and soon they were avoiding me altogether. Then the tour call came, 3 weeks up the coast. Brisbane to Cairns. I packed my bags, locked my room, and left them a note. Rent due end of month. See you soon. I figured they'd sort it. When I got back, the house was a war zone. Front door jimmied open. Lounge room trashed. Couch cushion slashed. TV smashed. Glass bottles shattered everywhere. My kitchen stuff gone. The blender, the toaster, even the bloody microwave. The room's empty. Wardrobe's empty. They'd done a runner. And yeah, they owed me $600 in back rent. I called the cops, but without a lease, it was pointless. Civil matter, they said. I cleaned up, fuming, and moved out a month later. Fast forward 4 years. It's 2022, and life's better. I'm managing a small venue in the city, dating a girl named Mia who's smart, funny, and nothing like those sisters. We're at a pub in Fitzroy with mates, footy on the screens, punters yelling at the umps. I'm nursing a pint when this massive guy storms up, footballer build, veins popping in his neck. He grabs me by the collar and slams me against the bar.
You're the asshole who used to bash my sister?
He roared. The pub went quiet.
What the hell? Get off me!
I choke out, hands up. My friends jump in, pulling him back.
I'm Carly's brother, you piece of shit. Brad, she told us all about you. Black eyes, bruises, said you knocked her around for months.
I froze.
Kylie? That Kylie? Dude, I never laid a hand on her. We were just roommates. She and Jess ran off owing me money and trashed the place.
He wasn't having it.
She came home crying, showing the marks. Said it was you, the Yank roadie. Me and the boys from the footy club went to sort you out while you were away. You weren't there, so we... Well, we left a message.
My blood ran cold.
You trashed my house? Stole my stuff? Yeah, well, she said you deserved it. Wait, you're saying it wasn't you?
By now, the bartender's threatening to call the cops, so we step outside. Mia's there, wide-eyed, holding my arm. Noah, what's going on? I explain quickly. The roommates, the runner, the bruises that were never from me. Brad's pacing, fists clenched.
Kylie swore it was you. Said you got jealous when she started seeing Shane. Started hitting her to keep her in line.
Shane. I say, the name clicking. That was her boyfriend, the one who was actually beating her. I saw the marks and heard the fights. I told her to leave him, but she wouldn't. Brad stops, face paling.
Shane? That d***? They broke up years ago. She married some other bloke now.
We talk it out. Me spilling the details, him piecing it together. Turns out Kylie had spun the yarn to protect Shane, not wanting her family to hate him.
Family's everything to us. She knew we'd go after him if we found out.
He'd rally his footy mates, a dozen burly blokes to teach me a lesson. When I wasn't home, they vented on the house, smashing windows, nicking appliances to make it hurt. Jess had helped pack their stuff and skip town.
I'm sorry, mate. I messed up. Believed a word without questioning.
Brad says finally, extending a hand. I shake it, still shaking. It's your sister, man, I understand. Cost me a fortune, but is Kylie okay now? He nods.
Yeah, she's good. Got kids. Settled down.
We part ways awkwardly. Him buying me a round as apology. Me and I head home. Her quiet in the Uber.
That was insane. She lied to cover for her abuser? That's heartbreaking.
We talk late into the night. Mia opens up about her own past. A college boyfriend who'd gotten rough. Gaslit her into silence.
Women do that sometimes.
She says softly, protect the monster because admitting it means facing how broken you are.
The building sat at the corner of despair and delusion, That's what I called it, anyway. Half-joking to friends back home who couldn't believe I was still living there. It was a two-story brick relic from the early 1900s. Paint peeling like old skin. Windows that rattled when trucks went by on the main drag. Rent was cheap, though. And I was 25, working double shifts at the diner downtown, telling myself it was temporary. Frank lived in the ground floor unit right below the stairwell. Late 40s, maybe early 50s, hard to tell. Greasy hair pulled back, always in the same faded tee. First time we spoke, he was hauling a busted lawn chair up the stairs. "Hey, new girl," he said, grinning too wide. "You fly planes?" I laughed, thinking that it was a pickup line. "No, you? Used to. Cargo runs out of O'Hare. Crashed once. Walked away. God's honest." I nodded, edged past him. Everyone in that building had a story they told like it was currency. I didn't buy half of them. A couple of weeks later, I came home from a graveyard shift, and there it was, a giant cardboard sign leaning against the wall by his open door. Black marker, all caps. "Free beer for lovely ladies." An arrow pointed straight into his apartment. The door stood wide, lights on, TV blaring some old western. I stood there a second, keys in hand, half expecting a laugh track. No one came out. No lovely ladies showed up that night, or any night after. I told my friend Mara over coffee the next day. She snorted. "That's a felony waiting to happen. You report it?" "To who? The cops know him. They wave when they drive by." She shook her head. "Just keep your distance." I did. Mostly. His inventory grew. First, the plastic lawn chairs, stacked five high, price tags in Sharpie, $5 each. Then, bikinis, bright pink and lime green, dangling from the railing like flags of surrender. A rusted barbecue grill appeared one morning, wheels missing. I watched from my window as he dragged it out at 2 a.m., probably lifted from someone's backyard three blocks over. The neighborhood was full of people who left stuff outside because they had nowhere else to put it. Frank saw opportunity. One afternoon, I was carrying groceries up the stairs when he stepped out. "You got a man?" he asked, blocking the landing. I shifted the bags. "None of your business, Frank." "Touchy, whew. Just asking. You know why Western civilization circle in the drain? Women like you. Too proud. Too independent. You know, back in my day..." "Back in your day, you flew planes, right? Don't mock me. But seriously, if you're single, I make a mean spaghetti. Come by sometime." I pushed past him without answering. Heart hammering. Upstairs, I locked the door, leaned against it, and texted Mara. "Frank just called me a and invited me to dinner in the same sentence." Her reply? "Jesus. Get out of there." But rent was due, and moving cost money that I didn't have. The smoke alarm started going off every few nights. I'd wake to the piercing beep, the smell of charred meat drifting up through the floorboards. Frank would yell, "Just a steak! I got it under control!" Then silence. And then the alarm again, 10 minutes later. I pictured him passed out in a recliner, pan flaming on the stove. One time, the building manager pounded on his door for 20 minutes before Frank finally opened it, bleary-eyed, waving a spatula like a white flag. "False alarm," he told the manager. "Steak got away from me." "Frank, you're gonna burn the place down." "Well, then I'll fly us all out." The manager walked away, shaking his head. It escalated slowly. Frank started ranting at anyone who passed. To the guy on the first floor, "You voted for this mess, didn't you?" To the single mom across the hall, "Your kid's gonna end up like me if you don't watch it." To me, always me, the same flip-flop. One evening, I was unlocking my door, and he was right there. "You're killing this country, all you broads with your attitudes." I turned. "Go inside, Frank." He stepped closer. "But hey, if you're looking, I got time. We could watch the game. I got beer." "Leave me alone." He grinned. "Playing hard to get. I like that." Slammed the door, slid the chain. That night, I slept with a kitchen knife on the nightstand. I bolted upright at around 3 a.m., hard in my throat. It sounded like every dish in the world hitting concrete at once. I check my windows. Intact. Outside, nothing visible from my angle. I went back to bed, uneasy. Morning came. I stepped out to head to the store, and I stopped dead. The intersection was a crime scene. Shards of plates, mugs, bowls scattered across the asphalt like confetti. A broken bottleneck lay in the gutter. The neighbor woman, Stacy, rushed over. "You okay, Sophie?" she asked. "What the hell happened?" She glanced toward Frank's door. "He lost it last night. I told him no again when he asked me out. Said I was pathetic. He started screaming and then throwing everything out the window. Cut his leg bad on a broken plate. Sat there bleeding, laughing." I stared at the mess. "He needs help." She nodded. "Cops come, take him for a night. He comes back, same thing." As if summoned, Frank limped out. His leg was wrapped in what looked like an old t-shirt. He eased onto the curb and lit a cigarette. "Nice morning," he said cheerfully. "Air's crisp. Good day for flying." Stacy and I exchanged looks. I backed away. "Frank, you need a doctor." He waved me off. "They'll put nano GPS in me. Track me. No thanks." I pulled out my phone and dialed 911. "Yeah, there's a man who's hurt on the sidewalk. He smashed his kitchenware and he cut himself. He's refusing help." Frank heard the siren first. His eyes widened. He scrambled up, hobbling back inside, slammed the door. We heard furniture drag, and then yelling, "I'm not going! You can't make me! Lab rat! They're going to do testing on me!" The ambulance arrived, and then two cruisers. Officers knocked, talked through the door. Frank screamed back. After 20 minutes, they popped the lock. I watched from the steps as they coaxed him out. Slow, careful voices. He was crying by the end, head down, letting them guide him to the stretcher. They probably gave him something to calm him. He went limp halfway to the vehicle. Stacy touched my arm. "You did right." I nodded, but my hands shook. Frank was back 2 weeks later. He didn't put out signs anymore. Didn't drag furniture onto the sidewalk. He just sat on the stoop some evenings, staring at nothing. Once he looked up as I passed. "Sorry about the names, about everything." I paused. "Get help, Frank. Real help." He nodded, looked away. I moved out a month later, found a studio farther north, closer to work. Rent that I could almost afford without panic. Sometimes walking home after a late shift, I'll see a cardboard sign on a corner, some guy's desperate pitch for whatever he's selling, and my stomach twists. I cross the street, keep moving. I still wonder if Frank ever got the help he needed. I remember that stretch of the Appalachian Trail like it was yesterday, even though it was back in 2016. I had started my section hike from New Jersey, heading south toward Virginia. It hit on the section they call the Roller Coaster, just a stone's throw from Harper's Ferry. The name's no joke. Up and down, relentless hills that test your quads and your spirit. I'd been pushing hard, my pack heavy with the essentials. Tent, sleeping bag, a change of clothes, and that damn rain gear that I'd splurged on at REI. But when the storm rolled in, it was biblical. Thunder cracked and rain poured in sheets, turning the trail into a muddy river. My jacket gave out first, seams splitting like they'd never been sealed. Then my pants. Water wicked up my socks, soaked my boots, and by the time that I stumbled into the nearest shelter, I was a drowned rat, shivering and cursing under my breath. "This is bad," I muttered to myself. Everything was drenched. My sleeping bag felt like a sponge. My journal pages stuck together. I hung what I could on lines strung between trees, but the air was thick with humidity. No choice but to hunker down for the night and pray for sun the next day. I wasn't the only one. A couple of other hikers straggled in, but we kept to ourselves, too miserable for chit-chat. Morning brought weak light and no relief. My gear was still damp, so I spread it out and waited, nursing a lukewarm coffee from my jet boil. Around noon, I spotted movement off trail. A figure emerging from the woods, not on the path, but cutting straight through the underbrush. He wasn't a hiker, that much was clear. No backpack, no trekking poles, just jeans and a t-shirt clinging to his frame. He approached the shelter, glancing around before locking eyes on me.
Hey, you seen Chris or Jim?
I blinked, caught off guard. Trail names were the norm out here. People went by Rocket or Bear Bait, not plain old Chris or Jim. No, haven't run into anyone by those names. You hiking? He shook his head, pacing a little.
Nah, I walked from D.C. 80 miles, straight shot. They told me to meet him here. Got instructions, important shit.
D.C.? That was a hell of a walk, especially in jeans. I eyed him closer. Sweaty, disheveled, but no smell of booze or other things, just off. Who told you? He leaned in, voice dropping to a whisper.
Can't say, but I got information. The NSA's after me. They're listening, you know? Bugs everywhere. Chris and Jim, they're supposed to get me out.
My stomach twisted. Mental break. Had to be. I'd heard stories of folks cracking on the trail, but this guy wasn't even a thru-hiker. Pity welled up. As a woman alone, empathy was my default. But caution came first. Look, I don't know about that, but there is a free hostel not far. Maybe 4 hours south. It's enclosed. Got a stove. Ridge Runner lives next door. He might help. He nodded eagerly.
Yeah? Directions?
I sketched a quick map on a scrap of paper from my journal. Follow the white blazes. You'll see the sign for Bear's Den. Careful on the rocks, they're slick after rain.
Steve,
he said abruptly, extending a hand.
Name's Steve.
I shook it, my palm clammy.
I'm Trailblazer.
I lied, using my trail name. No real names for strangers. He took the map and vanished back into the woods. Not even a thank you. I watched him go, heart aching a bit. What if he was really in trouble? But nah, paranoia like that screams schizophrenia or something. I pushed it aside and focused on my gear, wringing out socks until they were merely damp. By late afternoon, my stuff was dry enough to pack. I shouldered my bag and hit the trail, legs protesting the roller coaster's ups and downs. I arrived at Bear's Den early evening. The hostel was as I'd described, a simple stone building with bunks and that wood-burning stove. Next to it, the Ridge Runner's house, a cozy cabin where the guy, Tom, I think his name was, kept an eye on things. As I crested the hill, voices carried. Angry ones. Tom was out front, red-faced, jabbing a finger at Steve, who stood defiant, arms crossed.
You can't just barge in here, Tom yelled. This is private property for hikers. Take the blue trail to the road and get gone, or I'm calling the cops for trespassing.
Steve shot back, voice rising.
I ain't trespassing. I'm waiting for my contacts. They left a message, I know it. Messages? You defaced the logbook, you lunatic. Get out.
I hung back in the trees, heart pounding. Steve looked wilder now. Hair matted, eyes bloodshot. A few hikers milled around the shelter watching the showdown. I slipped in quietly, dropping my pack on a bunk. One of the hikers, a wiry woman named Sparrow, sidled up.
You see that show? She whispered.
Yeah, what's going on? Sparrow rolled her eyes.
This weirdo shows up midday, no gear, looking like he crawled out of a dumpster. Starts flipping through the trail log like it's the Bible. Says he's decoding messages from Chris and Jim. Writes all over it. Crosses out entries. Scribbles nonsense about government spies.
Another hiker called Moose chimed in.
Yeah, and he argued with me earlier. I told him to chill, and he goes off about the NSA tracking him. And then he burns some papers in the stove. Sketchy as hell.
Jesus, I muttered, feigning shock. Inside, guilt gnawed at me.
I'd sent him here. But what else could I do? Call authorities on a maybe crazy guy in the middle of nowhere?
Sparrow leaned closer.
Tom's pissed because the log's ruined. It's our history, you know? Messages to friends, warnings about bears or water sources. This a**hole treats it like it's his personal conspiracy board.
We ate dinner in tense silence. Ramen for me, shared around the stove. The next morning, Steve was gone. Tom grumbled about it over coffee.
Told him to hike out or face the sheriff. He slunk off at dawn. Good riddance.
We all nodded, relieved. I never saw Steve again. Finished my section hike in Virginia, went home to my apartment in Philly. Back to real life. But every so often, I Google NSA Whistleblower 2016 or Missing Person DC Hiker. Nothing matches. Probably just a man lost in his mind. Episode over. And yet, in quiet moments, I wonder, what was his story? And what if, by sending him away, I'd sealed his fate?
I never wanted to do this. I spent most of my life trying to be the kind of person my mother would be proud of. But sometimes, life twists you into something unrecognizable. Something dark and violent. And you find yourself staring at your reflection, unable to comprehend the monster you've become. It all started when I landed my first job after college. Freshly minted with a degree and loaded with optimism. I joined a prestigious marketing firm in the heart of the city. At first, the excitement of a new career masked the underlying rot that permeated the office walls. But as the weeks turned into months, the shine wore off, and the ugly truth revealed itself. Our CEO, Mr. Harding, was the embodiment of everything wrong with capitalism. He was a greedy, manipulative tyrant who saw his employees not as people, but as tools to be exploited for his own gain. I'd sit in meetings, watching him spew corporate jargon with a slimy grin, all while the rest of us struggled to keep up with the unrealistic demands placed upon us. The job quickly consumed my life. I'd wake up at dawn, drag myself to the office, and work until the sun had long gone. My weekends were no better. The constant ping of work emails haunted me. Even in my supposed time off, my health deteriorated, my relationships crumbled, and relentless shimmering rage began to build within me. One night, as I sat alone in my dimly lit apartment, drowning in my sorrows and cheap whiskey, I stumbled upon a server on Discord. The posts were a mix of rants, dark humor, and occasionally detailed plans of rebellion. I became a regular, finding solace in a collective hatred shared by the members. But there was one post, one user in particular, who stood out to me. He went by the name Reckoner. His words were sharp, filled with a burning intensity that resonated deeply with me. We started chatting privately, sharing our mutual disdain for the system that enslaved us. He introduced me to others who felt the same, and slowly, an idea began to form. We need to send a message, Reckoner typed one night. Not just words, something that will make them truly understand our pain. The idea of finally doing something, of striking back at the source of my misery, was intoxicating. Reckoner proposed a plan that was as bold as it was dangerous. We would target Mr. Harding, Not with violence, but with exposure. We'd uncover and release the dirty secrets of his empire, showing the world what the true cost of his greed was. It started with hacking into Harding's personal email. Reckoner was a genius with computers, and within days, we had access to a trove of incriminating evidence. Emails detailing illegal deals, exploitation, and worse. We meticulously compiled everything, creating a dossier that would, well, ruin Harding's reputation and bring his empire down. The night we chose to act was perfect. The air was crisp, the sky clear. Reckoner and I, along with a few others from the forum, met in person for the first time. We sat in a small, dimly lit room, and the weight of our actions were pressing down on us. "Are we ready?" Reckoner asked, with his eyes scanning the room. There were nods in agreement. With a sense of determination, we began the process of releasing the information. We hacked into Harding's social media accounts, hosting the dossier for all to see. Within minutes, the posts went viral. I watched the chaos unfold from my apartment, my heart pounding with a mix of fear and exhilaration. News outlets picked up the story, and soon, Harding's name was plastered across every screen. The public outrage was immediate and overwhelming. But as the hours passed, my exhilaration turned to dread. Harding's response was swift and brutal. He had powerful connections, and it wasn't long before he tracked us down. One by one, my fellow conspirators went silent, disappearing without a trace. Fear gripped me as I realized that I was next. I spent sleepless nights watching my door, every creak and shadow sending my heart racing. I knew I couldn't run forever. Then, one night, there was a knock at my door. My blood ran cold. Slowly I opened it, and there were two men in suits, their expressions cold and menacing. "Mr. Davis," one of them said to me, his voice like ice, "you need to come with us." They took me to an undisclosed location, a sterile room with bright lights and no windows. Harding himself was there, sitting behind a desk, his face twisted in anger. "You think you can ruin me?" he snarled. "You had no idea who you were dealing with." For hours they questioned me, threatened me, tried to break me, but I refused to give in. I clung to the belief that what I had done was right. In the end, they let me go, but not without a warning. "Disappear," Harding said, his voice dripping with menace. "Or next time, you won't be so lucky." I took his advice. I changed my name, moved to a small town far away, and tried to rebuild. The fear never fully left, but over time it dulled. I found a job, made new friends, and slowly the nightmare of my past began to fade. Years passed, and one day I received a letter. It was from the Reckoner. He survived too, and continued to fight from the shadows. The letter was filled with hope and encouragement, a reminder that the battle against injustice was far from over. I smiled as I read his words. Despite everything, we made a difference. Harding's empire had never fully recovered, and the world was a little bit more aware of the corruption that lurked beneath the surface. In the end, it wasn't the system that destroyed me. It was my own actions. But I found redemption in the fight for justice, and I stood in the warm sunlight of my new home, realizing that maybe, just maybe, there was still hope for the world.